You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. If I could ask you to take your seats, ladies and gentlemen, we will get started. My name is Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies here at Brookings and the proud holder of the Gujianfu Cecilia Yenggu Chair in Taiwan Studies here at Brookings. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to our event today, Cross-Strait Relations Under the Tsai Ing-wen Administration. I think that we have an excellent lineup of experts to speak about these issues, and there are many sub-issues involved, and so I think we will all have a lot to learn. My main function as the convener is to thank a lot of other people for making this event possible. First of all, I want to thank the Institute for International Relations of National Zhengzhou University for co-sponsoring this event. And in particular, I would like to thank my good friend Arthur Ding for all the hard work that he has done in arranging things on the Taipei end of this. On the Washington end of this, this is yet another in a series of close collaborations between the Brookings Institution and the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And I would like to thank Chris Johnson and Scott Kennedy for their leadership in bringing this about. There are a lot of staff people here at Brookings, at CSIS, and at IIR who've done the real work, and those of us who stand at the podium would not be at the podium without their hard work. Finally, I would like to express my appreciation to Taiwan's Mainland Affairs Council for their facilitation and encouragement. That means a lot to us. Actually, that's not the final thanks. The final thanks is to Ambassador Stanley Gao, who is the Republic of China's representative here in Washington, D.C., and he's kindly agreed to take time out of his very busy schedule to make some welcoming remarks. So without further ado, Ambassador Gao.
Thank you very much, Dr. Richard Bush, and thank you all very much for having me this morning. And on behalf of TECRO, I'd like to, of course, thank and congratulate, you know, the Brookings, CSIS, of course, Minister Lin, and also Dean of IIR, to put together such a wonderful and equally meaningful, you know, conference today. And, of course, National Zhengzhou University, of course, plays a big part in this exercise. And I'm so very proud and extremely, you know, pleased. Also, you know, Zhengda is my alma mater. And, of course, this is very important and very interesting topic. And President Tsai Ing-wen, of course, in her May 20th inaugural speech, and then followed by several media interviews and some public announcements, public statements. She has repeatedly talking about one of the key parts of agenda would be to maintain, you know, a status quo, a presumably dynamic status quo, so as to pursue a consistent, a predictable, and sustainable cross-strait relations without compromising, you know, Taiwan's sovereignty and the political democracy and economic prosperity. And this is the ultimate values and interest of Taiwan, of course, constitutionally called the Republic of China, and what the country stands for. And nobody, of course, including Tsai Ing-wen herself, would believe this is an easy job, you know, ahead. But during her career as a teaching professor at Zhengda, and a chief trade negotiator. Then one of the early mainland China policy makers, then party chairwoman, now the first female head of state. She and her team, including Minister Lin, certainly have work cut out for her. But I think one of the fair observations, I think recently would be that, of course, she should not take anything for granted. She had to stay focused. But on the other hand, she should not be overtly optimistic nor pessimistic. Right now, stay calm, steadfast, and realistic, and forward-looking. So I think that's a very fair observation. I understand you are putting together some of the best and the brightest, most articulate thinkers and authors in this room and throughout the day. So I believe it will be most inspiring and stimulating intellectual exercise. So I wish you good luck. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador, and thank you, Richard, for hosting us here today. My name is Chris Johnson. I'm the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS, and I just want to also extend my warm welcome to everyone for making the time to come and see us today. I have the great pleasure to be able to introduce Deputy Minister Lin to come and speak with us. We're very honored that you have taken the time today to come and share your thoughts with us on this very important subject. Just a few brief biographic notes. Lin Zhengyi is currently, of course, the Deputy Minister of the Mainland Affairs Council in the Executive Yuan. Prior to his appointment, he served as a research fellow at the Institute for European and American Studies at Academica Sinica, as well as the Institute Director from 98 to 2003. From 2004 to 2005, he was the director of the Institute of International Relations at Zhengzhou University, and he also served as senior advisor for the National Security Council in 2003 and 2004. Dr. Lin holds a PhD and MA from the University of Virginia, as well as a BA and MA from National Zhengzhou University. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Vice Minister Lin.
Director Dr. Bush and Senior Advisor Chris Johnson, Director Arthur Dean, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I am deeply honored to be invited to attend the International Symposium jointly hosted today by the Brookings Institution, the CSIS, and National Chengchi University in Taiwan. The symposium takes on particular meaning and timing in the unique context of internal and external development in cross-trade relations. Today, I would like to talk on the current development in cross-trade relations and offer five observations from Taipei perspective. Observation number one, starting with respect for the 1992 talk, is the key to maintain peaceful status quo across the Taiwan Strait. In her inaugural address on May 20th this year, President Tsai Ing-wen made it clear, in 1992, Trade Exchange Foundation in Taiwan and the Association for Relations Across the Taiwan Strait in Beijing, through communication and negotiation, arrived at joint acknowledgments and understandings in the spirit of seeking common ground while setting aside differences, and that Taiwan respect this historic fact. This emphasized that the Tsai Ing-wen government will continue, based upon the existing political foundation, to promote the peaceful and stable development of cross-trade relations. The new government in Taiwan will conduct cross-trade affairs in accordance with the ROC Constitution, the Act governing relations between the people of Taiwan and the people of mainland China, and other relevant legislation. In this regard, the existing political foundation have four key elements. First, under the 1992 talk between the two institutions representing each side across the Taiwan Strait, Taipei and Beijing do reach joint acknowledgement of setting aside differences to seek common ground. And second, the existing ROC constitutional order. And third, the outcome of the over past 20 years of negotiation, almost 30th Quad-Trade Agreement was reached in the past more than 20 years, and interaction across the Taiwan Strait. And fourth, the democratic principle and the will of the people of Taiwan. Quad-Trade relations are a long-term process or dynamic evolution. Both Taipei and Beijing need to show patience and wisdom and work jointly to maintain the status quo of peaceful and stable development across the Taiwan Strait. In her May 20th address, President Tsai tried to narrow down the differences between the two sides of the Taiwan Strait, avoiding provocation and surprises to set up consistent, predictable, and sustainable cross-strait relations. This firm pledge demonstrates an attitude and determination to conduct cross-strait affairs, as well as to preserve the core values of the people of Taiwan in implementing the government cross-strait policy. Observation number two, opening the door for communication and consultation is the practical approach to handling cross-strait relations. Over the past 4 months since May 20th, the two sides of Taiwan Strait have sought to understand and acknowledge each other in spite of divergent view on the development of cross-strait relations. And they all exercise constraint either in Taipei or Beijing. Maintaining the status quo of cross-strait peace and stability is consistent with the development interest on both sides, as well as with the hope of the international community. The Tsai Ing-wen government believe that dialogue and communication are the keys to maintaining peaceful and stable cross-strait relations and to setting up mutual trust between the two sides. Mainland China insists that the 1992 consensus, that is, both sides of the Taiwan Strait are part of the one China, is the political foundation for cross-strait interaction. It has temporarily, since May 20th, suspended negotiation with Mainland Affairs Council and Trade Exchange Foundation in Taiwan, and this has presented challenges for cross-strait official communication and institutionalized negotiation, making it harder to reduce suspension and its risk. The government in Taiwan has handled major recent incidents, such as the missile misfire on July 1st, extradition of the Taiwanese telecommunication fraud suspect to mainland China, a tour bus travel accident on July 19th, and other major recent events in a timely manner based upon the well-being of the people and security consideration. We have used existing channels to keep Beijing informed and updated in order to reduce tension over these incidents. The Tsai Ing-wen government just completed personnel arrangement on this past Monday for the Trade Exchange Chairman, Dr. Tian Hong Mao, making positive steps to stabilize cross-strait relations. We believe that mutual concern and pragmatic handling by the two sides during the natural disaster and emergency in July highlight the importance of maintaining existing cross-strait communication mechanisms. It also demonstrates the goodwill and original intention of people-to-people exchanges between the two sides of Taiwan Strait, as well as contribute to the building of mutual trust and meanwhile development of cross-trade relations. Our observation number three, mutual understanding and dispute management, is the key to transforming cross-trade relations. The two sides of the Taiwan Strait have been divided for nearly 70 years. During this time, Taiwan has developed as a democracy with a civil society and diverse public opinion, while mainland China has significantly deepened governance reform and systematically transformed. President Tsai admired Chairman Xi Jinping's courage in tackling corruption in the development of the Chinese society. Different perspective and even contradiction exist between the two sides of the Taiwan Strait. And it is these differences that create a need and also a necessity for mutual understanding, pragmatic communication, and dispute management. We need to set aside our differences and seek common ground. Any negative reading by one side or the other side's position and policy could better be avoided. Otherwise, it will only create more misunderstanding and concern and prevent the build-up of the mutual trust and opportunity for cooperation between the two sides. We hope both sides can set aside the baggage of history and mutually show goodwill. However, the key is that goodwill and dialogue must be rooted in mutual respect for different political systems and approaches to social function. Taipei and Beijing press a breaking or running in a period since May 20th. We do not expect our differences can be eliminated overnight, but we do hope that we can manage these differences and adjust cross-trade relations to reduce suspension and maximize the spread of cross-trade cooperation and make this the new norm in the development of cross-trade relations. And observation number four, joint cooperation and prosperity is the new paradigm for the development of cross-trade relations. Cross-trade relations form a key factor in building an Asia-Pacific security network. Taiwan will work hard to maintain peaceful and stable cross-trade relations, seek to participate in international organizations and their relative and related activities, contribute to the international community to bring regional peace and prosperity. We are facing up mainland China rising political and economic trends and international influence. We hope that Beijing authority will care more about the rights of the Taiwan participation in the international community. The Tsai Ing-wen government will continue to communicate with all parties and seek broad-based support, including from mainland China, to highlight Taiwan pocket of excellence, such as in the area of information technology and also the management or the knowledge-based economy, and both enable Taipei and Beijing to play to their strengths and jointly contribute to the international community. We face a period of slowing global economic development and a key moment for Taiwan as we seek breakthrough in our economic development. With new thinking, we will adjust and continue to support and promote cross-trade economic and trade exchanges and cooperation. We will participate in multilateral and bilateral economic cooperation and negotiation. The Thai government has announced the guidelines for the new southbound policy, seeking a human resource, capital, and information role for Taiwan to play in the regional economy and finding new external support for Taiwan economy. This new southbound policy is not politically driven, rather it is complementary to the development of quad-trade economic and trade relations. We are willing to jointly participate with mainland China on issues related to regional development, exchange view, and explore all possibilities for cooperation and collaboration. And observation number five, defending the values of democracy and peace is the significant for the Southeast U.S.-Taiwan relations. Taiwan-U.S. relations are at their best in over past 60 years. U.S. President Barack Obama has encouraged the two sides toward a position of creating link, reducing tension, promoting stability, and advancing development on the basis of dignity and respect. This has become the foundation for setting up quad-trade peace and stability. The U.S. Congress recently, in May and this year, passed a resolution to take concrete action affirming the importance of Taiwan Relations Act and seek assurances to Taiwan-U.S. relations. The friendly tie between Taiwan and the United States are built not only on long-term mutual trust and mutual benefit, but also, more importantly, on shared democratic values and beliefs. On Taiwan's trade-related issue, the U.S. has encouraged Beijing to continue dialogue with Taiwan. This is an important force supporting Taiwan. Since President Tsai Ing-wen took office, the U.S. government has reiterated that quad-trade peace and stability is consistent with American fundamental interests. We hope that the U.S. will continue to support Taiwan quad-trade policies, convey to mainland China the importance of quad-trade peace and stability, and urge Beijing to show greater flexibility and creativity and support the normal operation of quad-trade negotiation and official communication and liaison mechanism. And then my concluding remark. What we hope for quad-trade relations. Facing new quad-trade situation, Taiwan will continue to leave the door wide open for quad-trade communication and dialogue and work to create a friendly atmosphere and overcome deadlocks. The Mainland Affairs Council would like to propose the following appeal and action. And number one, each side of the Taiwan Strait should make an effort to show goodwill and gradually establish mutual trust. Each side should apply its wisdom to solve problems and show goodwill that could be echoed by the other side and then accumulate and build mutual trust. And number two, the two sides should communicate regardless of the humanity, the track one or track two, to build mutual awareness and understanding. Through communication, the two sides can elaborate on their intentions and desire to cooperate without provocation and to forge a consensus on which both sides of the Taiwan Strait can identify and provide positive momentum for cooperation. And number three, the two sides should put the well-being and the interests of the people first. The well-being of the people on both sides is central in the development of quad-trade relations. We hope that normal contact between the two sides can align quad-trade development in the direction and path consistent with the public expectation. The people first spirit can also provide momentum for further development between Taipei and Beijing. And number four, the Tsai Ing-wen government is committed to promoting legislation of quad-trade agreement oversight bill and maintaining meanwhile quad-trade interaction. We will make our effort to complete an effective and feasible oversight bill that can best meet needs of the society so that cross-trade exchanges and development will be continued on the sound and solid legal basis. And number five, the two sides should expand economic and trade exchanges and cooperation to bring mutual benefit. Institutional economic and trade exchanges and interaction across the Taiwan Strait can enable healthy industrial competition and mutualism. We welcome the further development of mainland China economic investment in Taiwan to bring more mutual benefit. Looking ahead, we hope that the cross-trade differences should not be obstacle hindering the development of cross-trade relations, but rather could be positive factor in promoting dialogue and cooperation. This is the only way to prevent the two sides from slipping into the vicious cycles of suspicion, doubt, interruption, and stagnation. At the same time, the ROC government of Taiwan thank the U.S. for its long-standing support for Taiwan in both official and private sector. The deepening of Taiwan-U.S. relations and the U.S. affirmation of Taiwan cross-trade policy are conducive to consolidating the pattern of peaceful and stable development across the Taiwan Strait, and also can strengthen the U.S. strategic presence in East Asia. In closing, I wish the symposium every success, and in particular, I want to thank the Mainland Affairs Council. Would like to thank, in particular, Dr. Richard Bush for his leadership to make this symposium possible on the day of the Mid-Autumn Festival in Taiwan, and also on the day of the typhoon hitting the island of Taiwan. I thank you.
Thank you, Minister Lin, for that outstanding presentation. I think that in spirit it was positive and forward-looking. In terms of its intellectual basis, it was sophisticated. And in terms of its recommendations, it was concrete. And so we thank you very much. We're sorry to take you away from home on the Mid-Autumn Festival. And I hope nothing bad happens with the typhoon that requires your presence there. So we have time for just a few questions. I will identify the questioner and then ask that you wait for the mic, identify yourself. Keep your question brief. Obviously, Minister Lin is a very smart man. You don't have to give a whole paragraph when a sentence will do. And so who would like to ask the first question? Okay, the gentleman right there. John Zong. I'm not surprised.
John Zong with CTI-TV of Taiwan, Zhongtian. Mr. Minister, the difference, it looks, the difference between 92 consensus and 92 talks has been narrowing to some extent. What do you foresee any possibility of further narrowing in that respect? Thank you.
In English, 1992 are the same. 92共识, 92会谈, 92 means 92. But since mid-20s, not only two words are identical, but also the common understanding, the joint acknowledgement, 共同认知. So maybe in the future, with the wisdom of leader from Beijing and Taipei, they could work out on the beauty of the Chinese letters.
Thank you very much. Next question. Donghua Yu.
Thank you. Dong Huiyu with China Review News Agency, Zhongping Shu. We all know that the channel, communication channel between your department and Tao has been suspended. I'm wondering if you have any second check or any other civilian channel to communicate with the other sides on the cross-strait relations. Thank you.
We have diverse, you just mentioned, Mainland Affairs Council and Taiwan Affairs Office. Even without the mutual two-side communication, we still keep Taiwan Affairs Office informed in any major policy development taken in the government. So it's one way, but we are looking forward to bilateral communication. It takes two to tango if you want to improve the cross-strait relations. And before going into the track two activities, we do have 23 cross-strait agreements. And there are focal points in those 23 cross-strait agreements. So in addition to Mainland Affairs Council and Track Exchange Foundation, we still have the government agencies, such as the Ministry of Transportation, the Ministry of Economic Affairs. They are responsible for handling and management in any communication with the Chinese counterpart. Beijing only suspended communication and negotiation with Mainland Affairs Council and Track Exchange Foundation, but as I just mentioned, the official communication in other different government agencies still continue.
Minister Lin, if I could ask to follow up with what I think is an implication of your remark, and that is that the working level communication regarding the implementation of the 23 agreements continues as before and is basically smooth. Is that correct?
To a certain extent, as I just mentioned, we send information, we send document from our Ministry of Transportation, and we are proposing to have the bilateral, for example, economic cooperation forum. It's the vice minister labels, but some delay in the process. But in the working level communication, still continue. Mm-hmm. But as I just mentioned, it takes two to tango. Yeah. When you are conducting an exercise related to maritime issue, it takes two to sit down and negotiate and arrange the schedule.
Another question. Gentleman at the back, right on the row, right there.
Thank you. Russell Hsiao with GTI, Global Taiwan Institute. My question is, Mr. Lin, thank you very much for your talk. My question is, in President Tsai's inaugural address, she mentioned the Act governing relations between the Taiwan area and mainland area. And I was wondering if you could shed some light on the significance of this pillar within the framework and governing relations between the two sides and your personal observation on that matter.
It's hard to hear.
In inaugural address, the ROC Constitution, in our Constitution, altogether 175 articles, but in the amendment, the number one, regarding how to meet the future national unification and the act governing relations between the people of Taiwan and mainland China. And also, in the very beginning, mentioning to meet the legal requirement in handling people-to-people exchanges before the national unification. So the wording has been there for a very long time period. And that might be the reason why Beijing, in one hand, they were satisfied with President Tsai in August remark. But on the other hand, they believe it is necessary but not sufficient. They still continue to push the envelope when the government in Taiwan to accept 1992 consensus. This is the second DPP government. In the past, previous DPP government and the Chen Shui-bian government did not accept the 1992 consensus. And the current government, we have different interpretation on 1992 consensus regarding the meaning, regarding the historic context. It's a very sensitive issue, and it takes wisdom for leader and working level or Taipei and Beijing to sit down to have the dialogue before that sensitive, touchy issue could be settled in the longer run.
Thank you. We have a very tight schedule today. I'm sure that we could keep asking you questions all morning, but you probably have other work to do. Let me again thank you very much for your very thorough and thoughtful presentation and for getting us off to a very good start. Thank you. So I would like to invite the panelists for the first panel to come up to the podium, and we will get started with our the next part of our program. So, so the title of this panel is Opportunities and Challenges in Cross-Strait Relations. By way of introduction, I would like to go back to that word under in the title of our overall program, Cross-Strait Relations Under the Tsai Ing-wen Administration. And I'd like to make the point that that word under has merely a chronological and not a causal connotation. What do I mean by that? We're talking about cross-strait relations in the context of a new leader in Taiwan, a new leader of the Republic of China, Dr. Tsai Ing-wen. She took office on May 20th. She was pretty clear during the campaign about what her policies would be. So it is not surprising that there might be a change in cross-strait relations as a result. But there's been a change in the approach from Beijing as well. One final point here. Tsai Ing-wen took office as a result of an election, and she does and must reflect the views of the many people who put her in office. So, but to talk about the opportunities and the challenges, and we hope there are more opportunities than challenges, we have four really outstanding experts. I'll just briefly introduce them because I know you have biographies available. The first is my good friend Arthur Ding Shufan. He's the research fellow and director of the Institute of International Relations at National Zhengzhou University. Dr. Yan Jianfa, he's professor at Genshin University of Science and Technology. My good friend David Brown, who is adjunct professor at the School of Advanced International Studies of the Johns Hopkins University. And Dr. Zhu Zhichun, who's associate professor and chair of the China Institute at Bucknell University. So Arthur, can you kick us off? You can speak at the podium, you can speak down there, whatever you want.
Okay, thank you, Richard. It's really my pleasure to work with Richard to organize the this conference, and also thanks for the MAC support. The topic assigned to me is about the opportunity and the challenge. So probably let me first address the current status in the Taiwan trade. Well, the different the term has been used. A friend in Beijing and Shanghai says that it's a so-called co-peace 冷和. And Raymond Burkhardt in Taipei yesterday, yesterday or a couple of days ago, he says stalemate without the crisis. Anyway, so either it's 冷和 or stalemate without crisis implies that the some kind of peace and stability has been maintained, and this created kind of a opportunity for moving forward. So I think the then maybe let me explain how it was made. There's no doubt. I think the President Tsai in her inaugural speech really make a tremendous effort and moving probably at least one step forward than what she said last year at the CSIS, I guess. As Deputy Minister Lin, he said that in her inaugural speech, she mentioned ROC Constitution, the Act governing the Taiwan area and the China mainland area, so on and so forth. So I think the he really made a tremendous effort moving her position at least one step forward, or you can say it's two steps, it does not matter at all, and in a direction that the which can meet, I would say, at least can partially or completely meet the expectation from Beijing in Taipei or in Washington D.C. I think that's the contribution she made. For President Xi, we know that Beijing's comments of her inaugural speech is about so-called incomplete. Why is it incomplete? I think the and why is no so-called the Didong Sanyao earthquake and the mountain shake? I think the this for once involved definition of how should we interpret this four character remark, Didong Sanyao. It's a goal or it's a adjective to show his concern about the future. I think it should be an adjective rather than a goal, because if we look back to several years ago when he President Xi met the our former premier Vincent Xiao at the Boa Luntan, President Xi also made a remark that the so-called the cross-strait issue cannot be delayed generation after generation. So at that time, people worried that it might be a timetable, but actually, several years has been passed. Apparently, it shows its concern, its urgency, but it's not a timetable. So I think how should we interpret it? Another four character, the Didong Sanyao, means that it's not a goal to heavily punish the President Tsai and the new administration. It, again, to show its concern about the potential consequence if President Tsai didn't somewhat modify her position. So that's why this one factor. Another one is the for President Xi, we all know that he's fighting an all-front war inside China. You know, from politics, military, and economics. You know, he's fighting all-front war, and particularly he has taken such a harsh action against the so-called those. Party or government official, which is charged as kind of corrupt, corruption, then if he take such a kind of a harsh action, then how can he take a somewhat moderate approach toward President Tsai? So that's why also I think the President Xi also meeting President Tsai somewhere in between, I would say. Well, look about the future. 10 minutes is really quick. Talk about the future. I think the President Tsai is committed. President Tsai is very committed to what Xi has said, and so definitely, we don't need to worry about she might change her position. Particularly, I think it's very tough for her because we know that her popularity has dropped almost below 50, around 50%. And if you read Taiwan media, you know she has been attacked by his the attack from his the party factions and also from the different social sectors, particularly also from the blue camp. There's no doubt about. But I think the although she's facing such kind of a difficult in amid the so-called dropping. A declining popularity, but I think he definitely sure made his commitment and will keep her commitment continue, because we all know she used to be the head of the Mainland Affairs Council. He know how difficult it is, and he know the sensitivity, and so that I think she definitely will keep his promise and her commitment. Particularly, she's a lawyer. I think for President Xi, as I said earlier, he's fighting all front war, and I think the for him, priorities in domestic front. First, he has to finish something in the coming the plenary meeting, the Central Committee plenary meeting, sometime in October. And again, 1 year later, the so-called 19th Party Congress. We don't know what kind of outcome would be, but definitely it will be a definite critical arrangement for him and for her so-called blueprint. And so I think that's why domestic issue should be occupy his priority. And Taiwan, as long as President Tsai keep her commitment, and there's no hurry for President Xi to take any kind of actions. And also, President Xi already take some kind of so-called sanction, if you can call it. You know, we all know that the declining number of the Chinese tourists, and the declining exchange students, so on and so forth. So as long as I think President Tsai can keep her commitment, then there's no hurry for President Xi to take further harsh action against her and against Taiwan. And I think also I think President Xi also worried that she should not be blamed for to break the current peace and stability, because once he take a harsh action, he cannot risk this kind of a cost. So I think the overall in the next before the end of the party congress next year, then the current peace and stability will be stayed. And I think and also we can see the sanction taken by Beijing is somewhat limited, because we see. Although we see sanctions, but Beijing also takes unilateral actions, try to deepen the ties with Taiwan. You know, we see all kind of a summer program, encourage Taiwanese students, and a program to help the Taiwanese younger generation to build on their so-called business. And there's a rumor says that so-called national treatment will be offered to the Taiwanese business. So you can see Beijing also try to working hard so that the current very, I would say, this kind of a peace and stability can be maintained and in the near future, and for the both sides to find other opportunity to make breakthrough. This is my presentation.
Thank you very much. Right on time. Professor Yan.
Thank you, Chair. Ladies and gentlemen, this is my great honor to be here sharing my observation with all of our audience in this room. I would like to elaborate more based upon Dr. Dean's presentation. Basically, I think we don't know that the cross regulations now are at a stalemate. And that's because mainly because of a Beijing factor. As we know that Beijing has cut all the formal channels and even the think tank context, especially the think tank concept with the green with green background. Even scholars are not allowed to meet our DPP members like me. And so this is a way Beijing now is trying to testify the Tsai Ing-wen's government's capacities and also the mind of Taiwanese people. So I think there was a long journey to go. I think we will have a lot of challenges in ahead. And partly, I think basically the reason why Beijing tried to cut all the formal channels just because Beijing is trying to push Tsai Ing-wen to accept 92 consensus. Because as you know that if Taiwan accept 92 consensus, then cross-strait issue will become a domestic one. If cross-strait relations is a domestic one, then the U.S. will lose the moral or legal ground to intervene the Taiwan issue. So I think this is the basis strategy behind Beijing's calculation. And of course, we all know that now Xi Jinping is very busy. Now what Beijing concerned is on the 19th Party Congress the end of next year. So he's trying to marginalize the Taiwan issue. And because if, as a matter of fact, if you see that the elections in 2014 and the 2016, basically Taiwan's political landscape has turned green. So if Beijing faced this reality, then Beijing has to do something. But this is not a good timing for Xi Jinping to take any radical approach against Taiwan or even trigger a war, because now he has encountered a lot of difficulties, challenges. Internally speaking, especially economy, we know that Xi Jinping inaugurated the Secretary General of the CCP in the end of 2012, and China's economy started to decline in 2012. So this is not a good timing for Xi Jinping. And we also see that there are a lot of social complaints inside China. That's why Xi Jinping arrested thousands of lawyers for human rights. And so a lot of difficulties inside China. And also we see that basically in the past 3 years, China has been, I don't want to say content, but beloved by United States and U.S. allies, from the North to Northeast Asia to the Southeast Asia. We see that when U.S. and Korea decided to deploy that system, that means that the China and South Korean relationship will not come back to the former situation. And China and Japan relations also turned sour, especially after the nationalization of fission islands, Senkaku Islands. And you see the ruling of the Hague has claimed that basically China's sovereign claim failed. And looking at Vietnam had a strong protest against China in May of 2014. Myanmar. Myanmar just shifted its loyalty to the West. And India, you see that India now is very sensitive to the rise of China in Southeast Asia, South China Sea and Indian Ocean. So basically, you will see that now Chinese diplomatic relations are very difficult. And so under these circumstances, I don't think this is a good timing for China to take a radical approach. So what will Xi Jinping do in coping with Taiwan's situation? I believe Beijing will use the conventional means. That's called three wars: legal wars, media wars, and psychology war. Psychology warfare. And you'll see that that's why Xi Jinping and his administration reiterate 92 consensus or One China principle again and again. And also, we know that some media has been, has been bought by Beijing authority in Taiwan. So they will try to promote 92 consensus for Beijing government. And also use the psychology warfare to try to baffling the Taiwanese people and even try to isolate the Chinese government. Xi Jinping administration also used some concrete measures like to control the flow of Chinese students and Chinese tourists, and even try to control the importation of Taiwanese agricultural produces. But I think this is only the beginning of the test. If Taiwanese government compromise, if Taiwanese people compromise, then I mean they will trigger another wave. But if that the kind of measures failed, they will try another one. So there was a long way to go. And so this is an opportunity for Taiwanese to testify our determination and our capacities. So this is why Tsai Ing-wen has to do a lot in the internal reform, economic reform and social reform. That's very important because this is the foundation for Tsai's leadership. And the other is southbound policy because we have a lot of small to medium-sized enterprises lost money a lot in China. And Chinese people always, especially scholars, criticize that we are the troublemaker because we trigger the wave of a southbound policy. But basically, this is not. If you look at a One Belt, One Road, the One Road is basically a kind of a southbound policy. And that was proposed in September 2013, earlier than our southbound policy. So this is we cannot put all our eggs in the same basket. So this is very, very important strategy for us. And of course, I think it is quite a beginning for our testing. And we have to show our determination. And we have to be very, very rational, pragmatic, and realistic. Because we know that we should be a responsible stakeholder in this region. And we know our good partner, United States, even we have no formal links, but we have very strong, substantial links. And we also have very good connections with Japan and Southeast Asia. So I think in this regard, I'm very optimistic about Taiwan's future. And I think if we can experience this hardship experience and testing, then we will revive. And so this is a good opportunity for Taiwan to survive and try to get rid of Chinese domination. And someday, maybe if we become strong enough, we have more bargaining chips and more capacity to cope with China, to negotiate with China. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very good points. David Brown.
I too would like to thank the sponsors for inviting me. With 10 minutes, I'm going to have to move quickly. My overall assessment of cross-strait relations since Tsai Ing-wen's election is that things are quite a bit better than I had expected. On the unfortunate or negative side, it is true that there is still a fundamental divide between Beijing and Taipei on sort of core principles upon which relations will be based. I don't expect Beijing to give up its core principles with respect to One China, and I don't expect Tsai Ing-wen to give up her core principles with respect to democracy. So the chances of being able to bridge this divide are limited. But I see both sides trying to do that, and I hope they will continue despite the poor prospects. On the better news side, some things that people thought would happen haven't happened. The most important of which, I think, is that Beijing has exercised restraint with respect to Taipei's diplomatic allies. And on Taipei's side, with the UNGA opening this week, we are reminded that Tsai Ing-wen is not pursuing Chen Shui-bian and Li Denghui's approach to obtaining observer status in the UN, but is focusing on ways for meaningful participation in specialized agencies and this new term, meaningful contributions to the international community. And despite the fact that the institutionalized communication isn't working, as Minister Lin noted, there are other ways of communication going on, to use his term, to a certain extent. And so all communications hasn't been suspended. Now, while there is an impasse on these core principles, things have happened. And each side has had to deal with pragmatic issues as they come along. And some of these have been handled smoothly. I would start by saying that when the oversight bill was launched into the LY in February, I think it was, there were several versions that put it in a two-states context. Tsai Ing-wen used her influence to put it back into a cross-strait context, and then in her inaugural address said that relations of her government would be conducted on the basis of the Constitution and the statutes so far, i.e. that there, that the way she's handling the cross-strait bill is put into a larger context. Secondly, a week after her inauguration, the WHA took place. And lo and behold, her Minister of Health was able to go to Geneva and participate in a smooth manner representing Taiwan's interests in international health. That was an accomplishment. Thirdly, Minister Lin mentioned the tragic bus fire in July. This was a challenge for Beijing. It had to find a way to get its people to Taipei in order to deal with this issue. And so they organized a tourism association delegation that was made up almost exclusively of government officials wearing other hats, very creative. It was a pragmatic way to deal with things. And then this week we've seen an example of the so-called Jinmen Agreement being used for the exchange of convicts and people that each side wants to be rid of in the legal area. And all of these seem to me to be examples of pragmatic ways both sides have worked to handle issues. Now, some things haven't been handled very well, and the most important of those is the way Beijing has continued to force or entice other governments to repatriate people who are ROC nationals who've committed crimes or are accused of committed crimes, or even some who have been judged to be not guilty of crimes, have them sent off to Beijing into the never-never land of criminal justice in the PRC. That is a very negative development. Now, each side has serious concerns, nevertheless, very serious concerns about what the other side is doing. If I were to look at Beijing's side of the equation, their biggest concern is that the Tsai government is pursuing a policy of disinification, as they put it, which is designed to sort of consolidate the sense, from their view, to consolidate the sense that Taiwan is a separate society, completely separate from the mainland. And in the months ahead, LY is going to be considering the transitional justice bill, and that is going to raise other matters of concern to Beijing. Now, on Tsai Ing-wen's side, you don't hear much about what her fundamental underlying concerns are, but I think I know what they are, and that is that Beijing will use its very considerable international influence to frustrate her effort to revitalize the Taiwan economy, in part by expanding and broadening Taiwan's economic relations around the world, but particularly under this government, through their new southbound policy, which is going to require the negotiation of all kinds of new agreements with various governments in Southeast Asia to facilitate the kind of expanded economic ties that Taiwan wants. And behind that, if we ever get TPP approved in the United States and that becomes a reality, that Beijing will use its influence to block Taiwan's participation in TPP. So there are very deep mistrusts and concern underlying the relationship, despite the fact that some things have been handled skillfully. Now, I'm cautiously optimistic about the future, for some of the same reasons that have been mentioned. But I'll put them in a different way. It's because I think that if you look at the last 9 months, you will see signs that it is in each side's interest to maintain this kind of somewhat stable, peaceful relationship and prevent it from running off the rails into a period of tension. It is Beijing's, in Xi Jinping and Beijing's interest for the reason, one of the reasons that's been cited. He's got too many other problems which are more urgent and more pressing. Tsai Ing-wen has helped him out by taking a moderate approach, and with Tsai taking this moderate approach, he can, in effect, put the Taiwan issue aside while he manages all of his other problems and steers through the 19th Party Congress problems. But he has another interest. That is that every Chinese leader must have a policy towards Taiwan that seems to have some prospect of being successful. And his policy that he's accepted is the so-called peaceful development policy. And that requires him to keep working at strengthening people-to-people ties, at least with Taiwan. Now, if you look at Tsai Ing-wen, I think she has two compelling interests as well, to stay on course in a way that should be reassuring to Beijing, that she's not going to pull a Ibian Iguo sudden change of course the way they fear. And those interests are, first of all, that she wants to be reelected. And to get reelected, she has to do two things. She has to show the people of Taiwan who elected her that she can manage cross-strait relations successfully, maintain peace and stability, and deprive the KMT of this way of attacking. And secondly, she has to revive the Taiwan economy, because if it doesn't revive, she's going to have a difficult time persuading people to let her stay on. So I think those reasons explain why things are better than expected and give us hope that they will remain manageable in the future. Now, I'm supposed to come up with some opportunities, and I'm going to go back to something that's been mentioned a couple of times, and that is this language that Tsai Ing-wen used, which was that we will conduct relations based upon the Constitution, the Cross-Strait Statute, and other laws. I think that was an extraordinarily important statement, and one of the reasons why she got a partial completion on her grade from Beijing. But I think Beijing is fearful that she's going to do this Ibian Iguo change of course at some point, that she can reinterpret the Constitution in a different way. Isn't she the one who helped Lee Teng-hui interpret it in a certain way 15 years ago. So they're afraid. Anyways, I hope they will take another look and find a way to use this statement and maybe combine it with something else so that a new formula can be found. And the second area of opportunity is cross-strait economic relations. Minister Lin has, in talking about the future, said they want good economic ties with the mainland. I think it's in Beijing's interest. It has been in Beijing's interest since 79 to promote closer economic ties because they see it as a way of tying Taiwan to the mainland. So both have an interest in this. And I believe that eventually, maybe 2 years from now, they will find a way to come back to the merchandise trade agreement negotiations and the services trade agreement. Because if they don't do that, other countries are going to be much more competitive in the China market than Taiwan is, and it will not be in either Beijing or Taiwan's interest to let that happen. I apologize for going over. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. Professor Zhu?
First of all, thank Dr. Bush and other organizers for having this conference and having me here. Within the time allowed, I focus on the relationship at the official level. But I want to point out, first of all, that this is a complicated and multifaceted in the relationship. Below the official level, you have the societal level, individual level. I want to add a dose of hope and optimism, perhaps, by pointing out that at the non-official level, actually, the relationship might not be that bad. For example, from the mainland's perspective, the public views towards Taiwan are not monolithic. You know, I think those of the mainlanders who have traveled to Taiwan and thousands of students who are studying in Taiwan or who have studied in Taiwan tend to have very fond views of Taiwan, and they are very impressed by, obviously, by the freedom of press, the cleanliness of Taiwan, and hospitality, and of course, the Taiwanese food. But of course, when we talk about the relationship from the official perspective, it can be frustrating. I want to add a few observations that have been mentioned. Then I also want to offer some comments on what we can do to move forward. First of all, I think both sides need to be commended for what has been happening so far. Obviously, President Tsai has been very cautious. She doesn't want to provoke Beijing, and she's taking a non-confrontational approach. And Beijing also has been practicing strategic impatience. I think, you know, if you compare Tsai Ing-wen and Chen Shui-bian or Li Teng-hui, I think probably Beijing lost hope in Chen Shui-bian and Li Teng-hui soon after they took office. But right now, I think Beijing still holds hope for Tsai Ing-wen. Because from Beijing's perspective, you know, she only gave an incomplete answer, you know. The answer is somewhat satisfactory, you know, maybe not completely satisfactory from Beijing's perspective. So Beijing is giving her more time to think about it, maybe to elaborate, to clarify her position. But of course, right now, Beijing has shut down the communication channels. And President Tsai has repeatedly said that she respects what happened in 1992, but she cannot publicly endorse 92 consensus. So the question is, when will Beijing run out of its patience? And what Beijing will do next is unpredictable. And I think largely depends on what Taipei will do next. Secondly, I think other panelists also mentioned that the cross-strait relationship is perhaps not the priority for both sides, and I agree with that. But on the other hand, the other side of the coin is that public dissatisfaction or pressure is growing on both sides. I mean, we know about these all these demonstrations taking place in Taiwan. It's interesting to see whether the DPP government will think that improving relations with Beijing may help rectify the situation at home. On the other hand, some of my colleagues mentioned that Xi Jinping is preoccupied with domestic issues. You know, he may not do anything before the 19th Party Congress next year, and I agree with that. But, however, public pressure may also be mounting inside the mainland. For example, recently there's this prominent scholar in Beijing who is talking about the timetable for settling the Taiwan issue by 2021. And also remember, President Xi Jinping is a strong man. He has a strong sense of mission. With or without public pressure, he may still do something about Taiwan as part of his Chinese dream. Another observation is that, interestingly for me, the United States, the biggest external stakeholder, has taken a hands-off approach so far. We all know that the shortest cut between Taipei and Beijing sometimes is via Washington. So perhaps Washington should do something, you know, to nudge the two sides to talk to each other. But I haven't noticed any efforts from U.S. side, at least publicly. For example, when asked to comment on Taiwan's participation in the UN, the U.S. State Department repeated its longstanding one-China policy based on the three communiques and the Taiwan Relations Act. And a number of U.S. Congress, members of U.S. Congress visited Taiwan recently. They also expressed their support for Taiwan's democracy. But I don't think there's any indication that these members of Congress encouraged cross-strait dialogue. So Washington's silence or inaction is very interesting, and I think it warrants some analysis. Now, moving forward, what can we do? I think flexibility is key, especially for Beijing. I think by now, Beijing fully understands that it may be unrealistic to hear the words 92 consensus from Tsai Ing-wen's mouth. But the question is, will Beijing accept something that is very close to 92 consensus? I think it should, and perhaps it will. We all know that the Taipei-Shanghai Forum went ahead. Taipei Mayor Ke Wen-je did not really endorse the 92 consensus. Of course, you can argue that he's just a municipal level official and he's not a DPP member. But still, I think what happened is very interesting here because Ke Wen-je was quoted as saying that the two sides of Taiwan Strait belong to the same family, Liang An Yi Jia Qing. So if President Tsai can move along that line, say something similar to that effect, I suspect that Beijing may be very happy to accept. I don't think Beijing will necessarily insist on hearing those four words, or Chinese words, right? Next, I think Taipei also needs to be pragmatic. I think a simple cost and benefit analysis perhaps can help President Tsai and the DPP government to more clearly define its position and meet Chinese side halfway. For example, what can Taiwan gain by refusing to recognize 92 consensus? And on the other hand, what will Taiwan lose if President Tsai explicitly or implicitly endorses the 92 consensus? I think this calculation may help the Taipei government to make decisions. Now, I want to also talk about this 92 consensus as a precondition. I think probably many people in Taiwan and maybe in this audience think that that's a precondition. But I think from Beijing's perspective, this is not a precondition because this was a consensus. This was a foundation of relatively warm economic and even political relations in the past 8 years. and it is also consistent with the ROC constitution. So Beijing can argue, actually, the new government in Taipei is attempting to change the status quo by refusing to endorse the 92 consensus that laid the foundation for the past 8 years. And because of President Tsai's DPP background, I think that's why Beijing wants some reassurance from her that she's not seeking formal independence. If a KMT individual is in power, maybe Beijing will not insist on that point. I think that's something we need to bear in mind. And also, from Beijing's perspective, President Tsai's position on cross-strait relations has not been very clear, because sometimes she talks about the ROC constitution that should guide the cross-strait relations. Sometimes she's talking about constitutional framework. Now, remember, constitution and constitutional framework are different things. The constitution is basically a one-China document. The constitutional framework means what is the situation in Taiwan now based on democracy, human rights, and President Tsai can easily use the public opinion in Taiwan, which is largely anti-CCP, as the foundation for her policy. That's why I think the Communist government, mainland government, wants to know exactly what President Tsai thinks. I hope that things will change very soon. And as we speak here, I think probably Dr. Tian Hongmao is reading the People's Daily in his office and waiting for facts from Beijing. I hope that the facts from Beijing will come soon with the words that saying that let's talk and congratulations. I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you all for those great presentations. Because you have shown such great discipline in time, we have 27 minutes till the coffee break. I am frankly bursting with questions I would like to ask and things I would like to say, but as moderator, I must show great forbearance and respect for the audience and just moderate the discussion. So please raise your hands if you want to ask a question. Wait for the mic. Let us know to whom the question is addressed. Keep the question simple so we can have other people, as many people as possible, ask questions. So who would like to go first? I see a hand back there. Is that it? Where was it? Oh, it's right to your left. Tony Kane
from American Councils for International Education. This might be a little off topic because nobody mentioned it, but I was surprised that nobody looked at one of the challenges in the cross-strait relationship as being what's happening in Hong Kong and the way Beijing sees at least some kind of Taiwan hand behind that. Is that because it's, did nobody mention it because it's not really an issue, or I'd like to hear some view of that.
Anybody want to do that, or I can take a shot?
I think you know more about this.
Just briefly, I think what connects the two is the greater anxiety in Beijing about national security. And they see situation in Hong Kong, situation in Taiwan, as national security issues, and they see both of those going badly. They also see a certain amount of interaction. The question they don't ask themselves is, how do our own policies create these situations that we're having such difficulty with? So next question. Jacques DeLisle, great. It's up here. Four rows back. Right up here, sorry.
This is Jacques DeLisle, University of Pennsylvania. to follow on Tony's question about broadening
the framework a little bit. No one said much about the U.S. election and how that might change opportunities and challenges, the third party to the cross-strait relationship. So I'd throw that out to whomever on the panel. And for Yin-Tian Fa in particular, if you would comment on how he thinks, sees the relationship with Japan as affecting opportunities. You mentioned it briefly, but if you could say a bit more.
Okay, we are having the last panel on U.S., Taiwan, China, but in deference to Jacques, does somebody want to talk about the U.S. election and what it might mean? Dave, you're the representative American.
One, I'm grateful that Taiwan issues are not part of the campaign. Secondly, I'm one of those who don't see how Trump can get to 270. And therefore, the question is, will Hillary Clinton's election have any big impact on these issues? And my answer would be no. I think she fits into the mainstream of American policymaking. The way she handled things when she was Secretary of State would not lead one to think there will be any significant change.
Okay. I happen to agree with that. Does anybody want to talk about PRC-Japan relations and how that might affect Taiwan? Arthur?
Okay. Actually, many friends from Beijing and Shanghai, they really worry about the potential the coalition relation between Taiwan and Japan, particularly after the May 20th. But we all know that the although, for instance, for the Japanese version of the TIA, it has been there for quite several years, but it has never been become a reality. So I think the as time goes by, the those particularly those know the Japanese politics and the Taiwan politics. If both group in Beijing they work together, they probably have. I think they should have a better picture of how far the Taiwan-Japan relation can go. There's no doubt the Prime Minister Abe or Japanese government under Prime Minister Abe really want to improve the relation with Taiwan, but there's some kind of we all know there's some kind of limits there because there's no kind of a formal diplomatic relation there. So those are what I know.
You have a comment on that? Go ahead, please. Yeah, please, if you
Of course, we know that Beijing has been very upset about the relationship between Taiwan and Japan. I think just because of the historical memory. But I think the best way to resolve the issue is to democratize Beijing politics. Looking at the Chinese tourists in Japan, there are a lot of Chinese tourists to go to Japan because they love the culture, love the goods there. And so basically this is not a, so the key issue is the Beijing itself, not the people, not the Chinese people. So now we have to see what is the key to resolve the whole issue across Taiwan Strait or across Japan and China or the world. So basically the point is Beijing authority. If Beijing can start its democratic reform and to treat their people nicely, then I believe there will be a prospect to look forward. Thank you.
Okay, another question. The person way in the back, and then I'll come to Deng Hui Yu.
Scott Harold from the RAND Corporation.
Scott.
Hi, Richard. I'd like to ask the panel as a whole, if they could, to weigh in on the issue of maritime disputes. Obviously, this is an area where China and Taiwan, in certain perspectives, have a confluence of interests. That confluence of interests is also somewhat problematic from the perspective of the United States and from Taipei, which does not want to perceive or have anyone perceive it as being sucked into an anti-Japan, anti-Philippines, pro-Beijing position. We've had the PCA ruling. That PCA ruling was responded to by Taipei in a way that was not uniformly welcomed across the region or in the United States. So I would just ask, now that we're 2 months after that, do you see any further steps where this is going to create problems for Taipei? Do you see any further evolution of Taipei's position? Or have we passed all of this and this is now a non-issue?
Arthur?
I try my best, Scott. I think the we all know that the President Tsai has different position over the so-called the South China Sea, different from President Ma. President Ma is quite the traditional Chinese way of thinking. So-called U-shaped lines belong to so-called the Republic of China or China. But I think the for President Tsai, not to publicly deny the so-called U-shaped line, but he neither publicly endorsed the U-shaped line. He used this term, but put the this issue in the so-called international law context. So there's a difference. You can see the difference between President Tsai and President Ma. And also different from Beijing's position. So I think the President Tsai is really take a very careful approach, because she knows the this is a very sensitive issue among Taiwan, Beijing, and the United States, and probably so-called Taiwan's neighboring countries. So President Tsai really take a very careful approach. If my interpretation is correct, but I cannot speak for her and for President Tsai, that the she probably put the our traditional claim in the context of the so-called international law. It's different from the President Ma's position.
Okay, other comments? Donghuayu.
Thank you. Donghuayu with China Review News Agency. You all seem to be quite happy with the status of the cross-strait relations now. But as Professor Zhu said, the key problem is, when will Beijing lose its patience? So my question for the panelist is, based on your estimation and your communication with the Chinese scholars, what's the timetable that the cross-strait relations enter the next stage? Will it be the Double Ten speech, or will there be any events or incident could change the momentum of the cross-strait relations? Thank you.
Speculations here? Okay, Professor Yan, and then we'll go to Professor.
We need a timetable in a life, but if we stick to the timetable, life will be very hard. So I cannot offer you a good answer, but you may ask Xi Jinping. But I think Chinese always play tricks. This is a matter of psychological warfare. And taking some example like Hong Kong issue, umbrella movement, Beijing had very hard on this event, but finally Beijing compromised. On the Japanese issue, China triggered a lot of protest in 58 cities, but finally Xi Jinping compromised. In the Vietnamese case, Vietnam triggered the protest against China. Finally, China compromised. So a lot of compromise. So I don't think we have to so pessimistic to Chinese. Chinese are very flexible. They just stick to the principle, but technically they are very flexible. But what is principle? Principle can last for 100 years, even 1,000 years. So we have to be very patient. of course, we have been very strong. Beijing only respect the strong side, strong party. So that's why I think we have to survive on our own. Thank you.
Professor Zhu?
I don't think there is a timetable right now. But at the same time, we also have to be aware that President Xi has this strong sense of mission, especially the Chinese Communist Party is talking about these two 100 years anniversaries. You know, by 2021, it's the 100 years anniversary of CCP, 2049, the 100 anniversary of the PRC's founding. I think he has a strong sense of historical mission, you know, to solve the Taiwan problem. You remember Deng Xiaoping said that we, you know, our generation doesn't have the wisdom to solve all these disputes, Japan, Taiwan, right? But let future generations resolve those problems. But I think President Xi Jinping has said several times that we cannot put off the Taiwan issue indefinitely. So that's some sort of a soft deadline, I think. I'm not that optimistic as Professor Yan. I think, you know, this will be a big problem in the next 20 or 30 years.
David?
I can't think of anything that is realistic and likely that will cause Beijing to be impatient. But I can think of things that are unlikely that would cause Beijing to be become impatient. One would be if the KMT collapsed as a party and there was no prospects whatsoever of it coming back into power. That would undermine the credibility of the peaceful development policy. But I think Beijing is reasonably optimistic at this point, maybe that Tsai Ing-wen may be a one-term president and that Xi Jinping would have an opportunity at the very end of his time to return to the effort that he was pursuing with Ma of trying to move cross-strait relations forward. If there's a split in the PRC leadership and over which Taiwan is an issue, then there might be a faction arguing for a different policy. And down the road, if the PRC got to the point where the PLA could come to the leadership and say, we are quite confident that we can solve this problem militarily, then I think they might become impatient. But I don't see that happening in the foreseeable future either. So no likely way of it happening, but several unlikely ways it might happen.
Professor, did you have a comment?
Probably piggyback on Jian Fa's comment that the, you know, the at least from DPP's perspective, the this kind of a timeline, October or, you know, actually it's kind of a psychological warfare launched from Beijing that create pressure against President Tsai, force her to make further concession. This kind of so-called timeline idea probably is not the realistic because, you know, any political leader, he probably would not make a concession under this kind of a pressure, I would say. Either, you know, look, even for Beijing leader, you know, in the 70-80 when Beijing was relatively weak, then pressure from United States, then you know, Deng Xiaoping stood up. And so I think the so-called the October expectation of the October statement and probably for the further concession, probably I would say it's not realistic, although it's not completely impossible, but for me it's a little bit unrealistic.
A couple of comments. Beijing does have the option of accepting less than Tsai Ing-wen saying the words they want to hear in exactly the way they want to hear them. There is a spectrum between absolute clarity and absolute ambiguity. So instead of worrying about, we should worry about Beijing losing patience, we should also think about Beijing's changing its expectations. The second thing I wanted to say, sort of along the lines of David of the unlikely but unexpected. I'm not sure there'll be a sort of big factional division within the PRC over Taiwan. But I can't imagine one of Xi Jinping's enemies, and there are not a few of them, in the run-up of the 19th Party Congress, making an issue of Taiwan just to put Xi Jinping on the defensive. And, you know, this is not a policy battle, it'll be a political battle, but, you know, he may decide to take some actions in order to respond to this. Did I see Mike Fonte's hand? Yes, I did see Mike Fonte's hand.
Thanks for, excuse me, great presentation. Mike Fonte, I'm the director of the DPP mission here. Just a quick comment. There has been comment that the U.S. has been quiet in the cross-strait issue, and I agree publicly. But I can tell you that there's been a lot of conversation, of course, going on behind the scenes, and I think that's true, particularly on the South China Sea issue. That is, the United States clearly does not want Taiwan to become provocative in any way, and to have said publicly we accept the decision that the nine-dashed line no longer is valid and historic waters argument is no longer valid would have been a very provocative statement, I think, by the Tsai administration. So you can see, again, I think Dr. Tsai being very careful in her presentation about how to speak about issues that don't provoke but also don't agree necessarily. I just wanted to make that as a quick comment. Thank you.
Comments from the panel? Okay. Another question. Yes. Qing Xin.
Okay, Qing Xin Yu from Zhengzhi University and also the Brookings Institution. My question goes to Dr. Yan. Actually, I enjoy your speech. And my question is that, well, you mentioned about some mass media in Taiwan right now, they are dancing in accordance with the Beijing's tone, right? And the other issue in my mind is that, well, we do find some people in Taiwan, in terms of different careers, they do express their idea about why the government do not accept the 92 consensus. So my point here is that, well, I'm not going to discuss the idea of 92 consensus or 92 talks. Instead, I try to say that, well, is that a good sign for Taiwan to present different ideas at this moment for the new government to formulate its own policy toward mainland China? That means with distant ideas and even conflicting ideas in our society. That's my comments here. Thank you.
Of course, we needed some innovation of the new idea, new formula, but it takes some time because Taiwan is a democracy. So we have to negotiate inside Taiwan. So I think this is a process. But now you will see that Tsai's government, ever since the presidential election, she has been focusing on a domestic issue, internal issue, because this is our main concern. And for the external relations, we just keep a low profile and realistic and stay responsible. So this is the policy that Taiwan has been taking. Thank you.
Okay. There's a question way at the back.
Hi, my name is Nadia Chow, Washington correspondent for Liberty Times. I just
have could you stand up and so we
sure.
can hear you a little better?
Yeah, I have a question about the KMT's role here. Not many people talk about it. I think last time when Chen Shui-bian got elected, you know, the chairperson Lian Zhan went to China to open a new dialogue and to change the whole dynamic. And after this election, you know, what role do you see that KMT is playing? And we know that recently Hong Shouzhu put the new party platform with the 92 consensus, but ignoring one China in different interpretation, which is a key ingredient for President Ma's China policy. So do you see KMT is changing as a strategy, and how Beijing view KMT's role? Thank you.
And I might ask how voters would view the KMT's role. Anybody want to answer that? Arthur, go first.
Well, I'm worried the KMT will be perceived as a deep blue and pro China political party is really my concern. If Chairwoman Hong Xiu-Zhu push her idea, because I don't want to make kind of speculation, but I think from what I can see, it's quite detrimental to KMT's development in Taiwan.
Other answers, David?
I am mystified by how the KMT believes that adopting this position will improve its ability to appeal to voters in Taiwan. And I've asked that question to several people within the KMT, and none of them have provided an adequate explanation. I did hear, however, that when they were in Beijing, they got the exact same question from the people in Beijing.
Anybody else? Professor Zhu.
We all know that CCP is used to dealing with the KMT, but I think things are changing, especially with the new chairwoman, Hong Shou-Zhu, who really, even within the KMT, does not represent the mainstream way of thinking in Taiwan. Rumors from Beijing indicate that Chairwoman Hong wants to kind of visit Beijing like Lian Zhan did, but I think Beijing is very cautious now, actually. Is kind of unwilling to receive her right now. That's what I heard. Thank you.
I think I'm going to bring this panel to a close. Do any of the panelists have a final thing they want to say? I want to thank each of you for outstanding and stimulating presentations. You can see from the quality of the questions the impact you've had. I want to thank you for your high-quality questions. I apologize in advance for the configuration of this room. So it's going to be sort of complicated getting back there and getting your coffee. If you want to go to the restroom, the sneakiest and best way to do it is to go out one of the side doors and then go through the middle corridor. But we will reconvene at 11:15. And thank you again.
All right, we're going to get started again. We have one more panelist to arrive who's going to... It's like a 737 here. You have a little corridor to get everyone to come on and off the plane. I'm Scott Kennedy. I'm Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS and also Director of our Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy. And it's an honor to be moderator for this panel on political and economic developments in mainland China. This is a topic over which you could have a full day or a full week conference, and we're going to do it in 75 minutes for you. And I think, of course, there's a whole range of questions one could ask. Some things that are on my mind that I hope the panelists touch upon, although they have every right to ignore anything that I'd suggest or ask. The first has to do with elite politics and the centralization under Xi Jinping and where things are going toward the 19th Party Congress. Hopefully they've already received detailed briefings from the leadership and will just report on that for us today. The second has to do with the Chinese bureaucracy, both at the central level and between the central government and localities. And that relationship, those relationships have evolved, I think in many ways potentially different from how they've been prior to Xi Jinping's arrival. And that certainly could affect how China engages with Taiwanese. And lastly, the economy, which I think everyone's aware faces a great deal of challenges and has a lot of volatility. China is currently implementing what they call supply-side reforms, which in some areas means reducing overcapacity, and in other areas, increasing supply of high-tech and high-value-added goods. In addition, they've got a considerable amount of debt as well, no small challenges. All of these things ought to affect how mainland China engages Taiwan and vice versa. Luckily, we have four terrific panelists. I'm not going to go into detail about their careers. You've got their biographies. And we're going to go along this order, which conveniently represents the distance from which they traveled to get here. So we're going to go from farthest to closest. We'll start with Xuse Jian, who is the president of the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy. Then Zhou Zhijie will go next, and he's professor at National Chung Kung University. And then from the south side of Chicago, my son goes to school in the north side, a little bit further away, Yang Dali, professor, University of Chicago, and then my partner in crime at CSIS, the holder of the Freeman Chair at CSIS, Chris Johnson. So each speaker will talk for about 10 minutes. You're happy to come up, welcome to come up here or sit where you are. We've got someone in the front who will remind you. Regardless of whether you're standing here or at your mic, just speak closely for recording purposes, and so all of our friends in the back and around the world can hear your thoughts. So we'll start first with Xuse Jian.
Thank you, Scott, for your introduction, and I would like to thank Brookings Institution, CSIS, and IR for inviting me to this very important event. today, I would like to talk about the title of my talk is Xi Jinping's Big Chess Match. I have this metaphor to describe the what he's facing. From last panel, we heard about remarks like, when is Xi Jinping going to lose his patience? I hope it's not his temper. And also, timetable for Tsai Ing-wen. Actually, there is a very hard timetable for Xi Jinping himself. That is the 19th Party Congress. That lays very hard constraint on his calculation. So here is the metaphor of chess match. I think Xi Jinping is facing four chess boards at the same time. The first, the most important one, can I use this? There's a light here. The middle?
Oh, yeah, no, that top.
The top, there. Okay. But anyway, let me use this. Yeah, this elite politics is actually the central of the picture, the center of the scenario that he's facing power struggles within his own ruling bloc. And he's also at the same time facing an economy that is slow, not only slowing down, but also faces a lot of pitfalls. And he is also facing a state-society relationship which he has put heavy hands on, pressed down a lot of NGOs and activists and lawyers. But lastly, but not the least, is a diplomatic security environment that China is facing. The thing is, with elite politics, it has ramification on all of these domains. But at the same time, the way he manages this domain, or are their own independent logic, for example, the structural adjustment of economy, the economy can also have implications for foreign environment. For example, when this global economy is slowing down, then and the China has this One Road, One Belt strategy, which will have very far-fetching strategic geopolitical implications. So actually, China needs a more friendly international environment, which sometimes is doing the contrary. If the domestic stability is not good, then there is an incentive for an authoritarian regime to appeal to some kind of external conflict to divert the domestic pressure. So these things are linked together. But at the same time, as I said, the way that things evolve in this domain independently can also have a reverse impact on elite politics. For example, the extent to which the economy has been well managed, the the oppression or suppression that the regime has put on the society, and the repercussion from environment, international environment, can all lead back to the pressure within the elite politics. As we all see, in this year, there has been some public letter registered to registering a complaint to Xi Jinping himself on the website of Xinjiang. You know, a letter from some comrades. They in, within the letter exactly was about this point. You know, and all these mistakes that they accuse Xi Jinping has made on these things. So this is, I think, the chess boards that Xi Jinping is facing. I'm going to skip some of these more theoretical things, but this is my academic view, that the China itself is a post-totalitarian authoritarianism. So there are certain constraints constraining its transition. To put in short, it's really difficult for a post-totalitarian regime to transform into a democracy very easily. You know, some people said both previous KMT, how many minutes? Five, okay. Some people say KMT and the CCP, they are all party states, so they should go through the same trajectory, but I have reservation on that. Because KMT was actually a half authoritarianism. It has election already, you know, when it moves to Taiwan. But in China, there is no substantial meaning for election. And this is a commitment problem. There are two kinds of commitment problem. One kind of commitment problem is between the dictator and his ruling colleagues, that the that there should be some kind of balance of power, balance among the factions, or the dictator should adhere to the explicit or implicit rules set among themselves, so that, you know, they don't have to worry about challenging each other. But these things have been broken by Xi Jinping's practices. Sometimes Xi Jinping doesn't have other choices, because sometimes the other factions are imposing personal threat to himself. So he has to fight back very harshly. And so his concentration of power and indiscriminate oppression of civil society actually exacerbates the problem of commitment problems. So who, we also talk about Xi Jinping's enemies in, from last panel. Who are his enemies? Actually, Xi Jinping has this perception that there is a threat to overthrow the regime by a clandestine coalition between overseas opponent forces, so to speak, 境外敌对势力, and domestic instigating elements. But actually, there's no one in the civil society that can really impose credible threat to the regime. They are all very separated, and there is no opposing political party. So the real enemy actually comes from within, particularly the threat to his personal power within the ruling elite circle. I identify three groups of enemies within the ruling elite circle. The first one is the Jiang Zemin remnant faction. I think most of the anti-corruption campaign is waged against this group of enemy, because they have posed threat, personal threat to him, close to a coup. And the second group is the Communist Youth League. We have seen news reporting that Communist Youth League school has been seized to recruit new students. I think that's very detrimental decision. And the third, actually, the most important group of enemy is the princelings families, because these princelings families, they are the ones originally supported Xi Jinping to come to the power, but they are also the ones that is the most important obstacles for his reform, particularly on the state enterprises, state-owned enterprises. So, and they are the one, they're also the one that could become potential alternative rulers. So Xi Jinping is facing this situation that it is really difficult to overcome the corruption problem because the corruption problem comes from within, particularly those princely families. So Xi Jinping, he needs an alternative legitimate source beyond the party. That's what he needs. So I think it is unlikely to have a direct transition to democracy, but more likely to transition to a new dictatorship, new form of dictatorship with a more democratic sugarcoating as an appearance. So the implication for cross-strait relations is that why is Xi Jinping losing his patience? Because he's too much challenge within. That is the reason. Not because Tsai Ing-wen complete half of the answer. She is still completing the answer. Why would anyone losing patience? I don't lose my patience with my students if they answer the exams. You know, you should keep the patience, encourage them, right? I never lose my patience. Otherwise, I'd be a bad teacher. I mean, and then why is always China losing its patience? Why is not Taiwan? Because it's more powerful. Okay, so that's the only logic. Not that we are doing wrong. So that's one thing. And I would say 92 consensus is actually not serving Xi Jinping's own purpose. Because once you hold onto this yardstick, you're pushing yourself to the corner of the room, not Tsai Ing-wen. Because once you step away from that, as Richard said, you will be challenged by your internal enemies in the Party Congress. So we would encourage them. We will not lose our patience. We would encourage Xi Jinping to think otherwise for the benefits of both sides. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sijian. Okay, we're going to turn now to Professor Zhou.
Thank you, Chair. Feel glad to be invited at this conference, and I want to share my observation about the recent China's socioeconomic development. But because of the limit of time, so I think I would like to focus on the societal dimension in China. Okay, I think that China's recent society is basically stable, but certainly not peaceful. It is to say that although the social arrest is still under the party state's control, but it revealed the extent of the difficulty of comprehensive deepening reform. Firstly, in terms of the social protest, according to my own research and the field study, the most protesting subject are people from social vulnerable groups, such as farmers, workers, and the migrant workers. And there are also, during the past 2 years, and there are also about 20% of protests initiated by people from the middle class. That's a new situation, such as teacher, business person, self-employment individual, and the business owner. So it shows that the middle class traditionally the middle class is exempt from the conflicts, but this new situation showed that the middle class is not exempt from the conflict caused by the transforming social structure and has to stand out for their own rights and benefit. As for the issue of protest, nine-tenths concerned materialism, okay, which means the pursuit of food, clothing, and the rights of survival. About one-tenth concerns post-materialism. It shows that the most protests are still driven by the pursuit of material benefit. So the government use of the suppression as means to response is higher than the past. On the contrary, the percentage of the use of the negotiation has decreased rapidly,
shows that the face of the government faced with the pressure of the Weiwen, especially local government has increased the use of suppression as a means of response. So the local government's previous strategy of paying money for peace, or we can say that using renminbi to resolve internal conflict, has started to change. As for the management of the social organizations in recent years, show that the three major trends for me. The first one is the relaxation of the dual management system. The second one is the purchase of public service by the government. And the third one is the establish the core gangos. Okay. And for the relaxation of the dual management system, some organizations in most provincial cities are only required to register at civil affairs authorities. However, the relaxation just applies to organizations helping the government with economic and social governance, such as business, technology, charity, and the community service sectors. Secondly, the purchase of public service by the government means that the government provide funds and the resources to attract civil groups to apply for the participation in social service. Thirdly, the establish of core, so-called core organizations means to have an existing civil group or new gango serve as a core organizations to share management of relevant grassroots organizations, or maybe you can say out of systems organization, or lay the lowest core organization to allocate the resources so as to achieve the government goal of the managing people with people or managing organization with organizations. So the three tendencies show the government's intention to involve social organizations in public service. Okay. So and for the overseas NGOs, all we know that the most recent change is the overseas NGO management law. And the Ministry of Public Security is entitled to monitor overseas NGOs and check their funding resources, funding sources and the development of their projects. Previously, the Ministry of Civil Affairs was the central minister that worked the most closely with overseas NGOs. But according to the new law drew up by the Minister of the Public Security, so it implies that it will further its control of overseas NGOs. And the possible negative consequence we're still observing. Okay. So generally, the government adapt both soft and hard approaches for the social control. The use of the social policy and the welfare to try to distribute the public discontent is a kind of a soft approach. While the pressure on the Protestant, regulation of NGOs, cyber control, and the arrest of human rights lawyer and some dissidents are hard approaches. So we can see the facts of the social unrest are mostly constrained by the party's forceful control. However, many problems are not resolved. Perhaps to some degree, the ruling by law emphasized by Xi Jinping might be a way out. But in fact, there is a little difference between Xi's policy in social control and the laws in the Hu Jintao and the Jiang Zemin's eras, for me. But the implementation of Xi Jinping's measure and the policies has been much more significantly enhanced. Okay. So my concrete remarks is that Xi now faces a critical moment, presented by the Professor Xu. So therefore, especially the pressure of a slowing economic continue to grow. So therefore, the political situation in China is characterized by the management of economic issue with political means. As the economic outlook becomes severe, the control of public opinion, the internet, and its party elite and official become stricter. So we can witness Xi, on the one hand, his sense of urgency to many reforms, try to run all the reforms in simultaneously. And on the other hand, a clear sense of a more authoritarian rule. That's all my point, and I beg you comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yang Dali.
I'll stand here so that people can see me. In fact, I see the on the screen here a very interesting Professor Xu's presentation on the chess match. In fact, I want to mention that President Xi, in fact, likes sports. In fact, there are investors who invest heavily now in soccer because that's one of the sports that he likes. So Chinese investors are buying football teams in Europe in particular. And in fact, there is speculation that some of those investments may even be listed back in China. But in fact, some of you may also know President Xi likes another game called Go. And in fact, when you read Henry Kissinger's book on China, he also starts with the fact that Chinese leaders actually, so this is important in thinking about Chinese thinking, because Go is a much more strategic game that's played more for the long haul. And of course, one of President Xi's former friends is, in fact, this a Go player by the name of Nie Weiping. So, but what I'm thinking, however, is President Xi likes all those sports besides chess, but he's playing them simultaneously. And that actually shows the kind of crowded agenda that he has. He has so many positions besides the presidency, besides the chairmanship of the Central Military Commission. He's also taking on leaderships of the economy, the foreign policy, reform, military reform, cybersecurity. It can go on and on. In fact, even if only a small proportion of the reforms that have been announced are fulfilled, he will be considered to be very successful. The challenge, however, is many people in China feel like that, in fact, he's not moving fast enough on many of those issues. In fact, some of the disenchantment comes from the fact that he's set such an ambitious agenda, and only so much has been achieved. But I think they are wrong in that regard, because a couple of the reforms that he's already launched, in fact, are in particular related to the anti-corruption campaign. You may know, and you read actually every day, there are officials who commit suicide. In some localities, whether it's Tianjin or Liaoning, there are more officials inside the jail than outside. At the senior levels. And at the same time, really, in many ways, has changed the dynamics of the bureaucracy, which is one of the issues that Scott has mentioned. Many officials that used to be able or would have been very aggressive in pursuing certain kind of construction projects in the past would not want to do them because they cannot get the card anymore and it's a political risk. Risk avoidance is key for Chinese officials today throughout the bureaucracy. And it's about avoiding the risk of political trouble in many ways, and that's very important. The other aspect related to the anti-corruption campaign is, in fact, in the military. We know that the two former vice chairmen of the Central Military Commission, one died while awaiting, or basically awaiting his death, otherwise he would have been persecuted. The other has been essentially thrown into in jail. So in that sense, it's the senior military establishment. Actually, it's not a joke. The saying is the Communist Party lost many more generals in the anti-corruption campaign than the entire anti-Japanese campaign or war in the 1930s and 40s, which is true in many ways, actually. But part of the issue is really relates to the fact that the Communist Party, the Red Army, didn't fight the Japanese as aggressively. So in this connection, in fact, President Xi has launched this far-reaching military reform, including a reconfiguration of the military command system. In fact, you really need the anti-corruption campaign in order to pursue the reforms. You need the authoritarian approach in order to be able to pursue reforms in various sectors, and especially in terms of the military. And of course, in the meantime, this is the way to consolidate, to really establish control. Because one of the big challenges for the Chinese leadership, in fact, is that when you become the president, people do not tender their resignation. You have to replace them over time, and you need to bring in your own people. And of course, finding one's own people is also another challenge in the process. As a result, I think actually you can see the kind of the Mahdi, the really what Arthur had mentioned to be an all-front war that President Xi is actually pursuing. And that's really the big challenge in this regard. Now, I do have to say that in this context, however, the leadership is very confident, generally speaking. They still have that confidence. Of course, they were the most confident in around 2009 to 2012, when the China model was at its zenith. In many ways. But if you read President Xi's speech to the G20 meeting in Hangzhou, he in fact included a line basically saying that China needs to propose solutions for issues of global governance. Now, that's actually not a line to be missed, because it again shows that the Chinese leadership are saying that China not only has found a way to continue to grow, but in fact that the actually now are in the leadership position in terms of thinking about global issues, and they want to be playing host, for example, to the G20, but also doing other issues, on other issues as well. In fact, historically, Chinese leaders, you have to go back to the time of the anti-Japanese war, when, for example, President Jiang at that time and President Roosevelt were constantly in communication. Today, of course, you have a Chinese leader who is actually communicating and meeting with the most foremost leaders of the world regularly. And he's around when President Obama has retired and so on. So therefore, he's acting as a global leader in a way that actually was not easy in the past in this regard. And in this case, I think I want to mention very briefly, actually, the grand strategy in this case. Because when you think about this ambition, the national ambition of being a global leader, you connect it with the One Belt, One Road initiative of China helping its domestic economy, but really reaching out to the Middle East, to Europe, and of course to other parts of the world. That's a very ambitious agenda. It just helps. It just happens to help with the domestic economy. But that ambition, however, harks back to Chinese history, to the Silk Road in particular. It also solves certain national security issues. For example, going through Pakistan would help to deal with, ameliorate the security bottlenecks in terms of having all the major source of oil going through the Malacca Strait, potentially. Now, in this connection, I do want to mention that the South China Sea disputes and the East China Sea, of course, we can pause on the details on all the issues, but it really fits into this global strategy of establishing or certainly making China stronger in terms of global strategy. And of course, as you all know, you go back to Sun Tzu and others, the strategy fundamentally is also to establish such a position for China so that it could win without having to fight, right? That's the ideal in terms of this kind of strategy. Of course, it doesn't always happen that way, but fundamentally, however, this is very important. And of course, in terms of the South China Sea and the East China Sea, it's so important to China's global reach in terms of the blue, in terms of the oceans and in terms of the global strategy in there. In terms of also, of course, in this connection of being able for China to stand up, and you look at this morning's paper in terms of what the Philippine president just mentioned, it actually really plays to that. And of course, in that context, Taiwan fits into the approach to Taiwan fits into this broader context. Now, I do want to mention this in my last minute or so. In fact, it's not that the Chinese leadership did not see what's happening in Taiwan coming. They did. They rushed to complete the deals with the Ma Ying-jeou administration in particular. The 23 agreements were their way to ratchet up relations between across the street so that actually they can really put a flaw in terms of this relationship. And in the context, however, they also anticipated that there would be some turbulence, but they don't really send it back to the Chen Shui-bian era in many ways. And of course, I think the talks earlier also indicated that relations continue in this with the agreements already. But at the same time, they can be patient, in fact. I do want to mention with the half minute remaining is that foreign policy and national policy today, however, are not just left to national leaders to decide. You look at North Korea, for example, the public sentiments in China is turning. Likewise, in the past, the Chinese leadership was able to use nationalism to affect relations with Japan. But today, so many Chinese from the mainland are traveling to Japan. They love it, it turned out. And those kind of sentiments are extremely important. And for the same reason, the leadership recognizes that nationalism is a dangerous weapon, in fact, to use. Whether it's with regard to Japan or North Korea or Taiwan for that matter. So in this context, I think actually that also helps to affect and to sort of really affect the framework for cross-strait relations. Thank you for your attention.
Terrific. Thanks so much, Dali. All right, well, our last presenter, Chris Johnson.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you to my co-panelists. Difficult to wrap up after all those good comments. I'm going to try to focus my comments a little bit more on the specific issue of the leadership transition that will be taking place next year, because I think while we've heard a lot today about how Xi Jinping is fighting a multi-front war with foreign policy and the economy and other issues, I think it's fair to say that most of the indications that we're getting, especially within the last month or so, is that his focus is now tunneling in very, very tightly on the Party Congress. There's several reasons for this. I think, first of all, President Xi has shown himself thus far to be very much a traditional Chinese leader. And in that, I think his view is people first and then policies. And so he understands and continues to understand and is reminded every day by the setup that he currently faces that getting the Politburo right and to his liking next year will be incredibly important. And I think has a lot to do with a lot of the perennial questions that we're facing as analysts, such as, is reform in China dead? You know, I'm just back from Beijing actually last night, and I'm quite struck by the sort of tone that you hear, the fewer and fewer people who are willing to sort of suggest that, well, you know, longstanding view has been, well, he's cracking down now, but then once he gets his way at the Party Congress, he'll, you know, remove the mask and show himself to be China's Gorbachev or whatever some people think. I can't see any indication of that. But more and more you get a sense of very much a gloomy picture. And it's because it's hard to see any elites in the Chinese system who are happy at this particular moment. Certainly, as some of my colleagues have highlighted, the high-level elites in the leadership don't like Xi Jinping very much. They're losing a lot of their power and influence because of his growing power and influence and his strength in the system. Business elites in China aren't happy for a number of reasons, especially SOEs, given the pressures they're facing and the likelihood of coming reforms. The only people who seem to be happy with Xi Jinping's leadership are the broad masses of the Chinese people, wherein he continues to still be quite popular, and I think that's something worth looking at. Secondly, I just want to touch on the fact that I think the challenge for us as analysts looking at Chinese domestic politics arguably now is the most difficult it's been in at least 20 or 30 years. I find it very difficult to try to get a sense of the directions. I think there's a couple reasons for this. One, as we've all seen and heard, Xi Jinping has made the system extraordinarily opaque. There are very few people now in the system, I think, who really know what's going on. And even if they know what's going on, they're not quite sure where Xi Jinping is. And this is very much part and parcel of his political style, which is to keep his cards very close to the vest, look very steady as he goes along, and then when no one's looking, swing around from behind and smack whomever his opponent of the day appears to be. And then the second thing is, I think
we see a situation in which the dynamism across Chinese society and its role in the world and in the region is such that the cycles, if you will, of the pendulum swinging on policy within the system are much faster than before. You know, when you had in the past, when we had these groupings dueling it out amongst each other, you know, it might swing this way for 6 months and then this way for 6 months. I find it quite interesting that it seems to be swinging almost monthly, if not faster, especially in recent months. If you look, especially on economic policy, you know, from the May 9th authoritative person article that got so much attention with regard to emphasizing supply side structural reform and worries about debt loads and so on, to what is very clearly in the last few weeks a swing back to an expansionary fiscal policy. Within the government spending, clearly there's a lot of tussle going on inside the system. So to look at it from the perspective of what is the best way, the best framework to understand how Xi Jinping is thinking about this, it's helpful, I think, to take a look at a few clues that we saw before the leadership went off for its summer vacation and policy discussions at Beidaihe, after that took place, and then look a little bit at Xi Jinping's strategy for the Party Congress. I would say in advance of the Beidaihe meetings, and you know, I know there are still some analysts who dispute whether the Beidaihe meetings take place anymore or not. All I can say is our team at CSIS looked at the issue very closely, and strangely enough, from July 30th to about August 12th, there were no appearances anywhere of any Politburo Standing Committee members save one, and that was Liu Yunshan at Beidaihe. So our sense is most likely they definitely went up there for their annual policy consultations. Prior to those meetings, it's quite striking that Xi Jinping hosted a Politburo meeting, I believe it was July 28th or 27th, right near the end of July, where he signaled that the theme for the plenum this fall, which will come up next month, would be these new discipline regulations for the party. And I find this to be quite striking in terms of what it tells us about Xi Jinping's agenda and how he thinks. Six plenums generally are about either culture or ideology or both in the Chinese system. So I find it quite striking that Xi Jinping's definition of culture and ideology is anti-corruption. That's very telling. Secondly, it was not by coincidence that right after that Politburo meeting, the organization department of the party and the party's Discipline Inspection Commission announced that they were sending out joint teams into the provinces to oversee succession in the provinces. So clearly, it was a message of intimidation, I think, from Xi Jinping before they headed off for these discussions, that I'm watching you. The anti-corruption campaign continues afoot, and don't mess with me, I think was basically the message. So what has happened since they seem to have concluded those meetings? Well, one, Xi Jinping held a very significant meeting on August 17th on his Belt and Road Initiative. And we saw the entire leading group of the leaders who oversee the Belt and Road Initiative, but more importantly, several key provincial party secretaries, many of whom are Politburo members, talking about their experience with Belt and Road and so on. So as to, in my sense, remind everyone in the collective audience in China that, you know, this is my signature initiative, I'm pushing this forward, and I'm, you know, claiming the agenda here. Secondly, we continue to see the anti-corruption campaign moving on. We just had the fall of the Tianjin mayor and longtime acting party secretary. That happened while I was there. And his quick replacement with Li Hongzhong, the party secretary from Hubei. There's lots of speculation, obviously, about what that means. But most interestingly is the effort to try to define, well, a lot of people, a lot of analysts had thought Huang Xingguo, the Tianjin mayor, was close to Xi Jinping. So why did he get collapsed? I think it's a sense on Xi Jinping's part that he's trying to signal the system, any of you who thought that the anti-corruption campaign is going to slow down anytime soon, this is another, you know, sort of argument you get very regularly, you're off base. Turning to sort of his strategy for the party Congress, I think what we're seeing develop and picked up in some of the comments by my colleagues is what you might call Xi Jinping's agenda for the Party Congress versus what you might call the agenda of the system, however you want to define the system inside China. Xi Jinping's agenda, in my assessment, is best described as disruptive for the Party Congress. And what do I mean by that? If he gets his way, my sense is that he will do several things that we would not expect. The first is he will not signal the succession, my sense, if he gets his way. Obviously, in the last several rounds of this, at the mid-cycle party Congress, we know who the next leader of China is going to be. In this case, I don't think that's going to happen if he gets his way, for several reasons, but I think actually the primary one is the sense that he feels he has to have as much power and authority as he possibly can for the second five-year term, or maybe the second on the way to the third. No one knows. There's a lot of speculation about that. Secondly, I think he will ignore a lot of the patterns of promotion that they have been sort of using in the last several rounds of party congresses. The so-called age restrictions, it's important to remember that, you know, these are not rules inside the Chinese system. If it's not in the party constitution, it's not a rule. Jiang Zemin invented these for purely political purposes, and there's no reason that Xi Jinping, with the power he has, can't maneuver those some more. But more importantly, I think he's going to strike at the sort of stepwise, institutionalized-looking way patterns of promotion. So take, for example, Li Yuanqiao, the current vice president, a Politburo member. Certainly by the practices they've been following for the last 20 years, he should be going to the Politburo Standing Committee. Obviously, there's lots of speculation that he might go to the jailhouse instead. We'll see whether or not that comes to be true. But I think if Xi Jinping gets his way, he won't be there. And so who's opposing Xi Jinping's agenda? We've had some comments from one of my colleagues as to who these groups might be. I prefer to look at it as what we might call the system, by which I mean those who want to see those patterns that they've been following for the last several rounds of transition continue to be followed. Why? Because they understand that Xi Jinping is going to make a play for a maximalist win at the Party Congress. And if he is successful, the groups that have been sort of influential in the last 20 years are going to lose, and he will have a much stronger hand. So the question really boils down to, can Xi Jinping amass enough power and persuade enough people to be able to disrupt those patterns that the system's been following for some time? So let me stop there and welcome questions.
Terrific. I think a very nice coverage of what's going on in China politically, economically. Some variation in terms of how much pressure people feel Xi is under versus how confident he ought to feel. I think one thing would be, who's right and who's wrong. Are people underestimating Xi, or is Xi overconfident? It's going to be one or the two. And then just simply the differences in perceptions also ought to affect how people behave and where things are going. But what I want to do now is turn to the audience and have you all feel free to ask questions again. Wait for the microphone. Identify yourself and your institution, and keep your comment in the form of a question. We'll go to the far back.
Gregory Ho from Radio Free Asia. My question is about successor. I'll see the Hong Kong successor issue, which is the more imminent and more an experimental to test the who inside the party have the control of a city that the most important among all. Now we call the CY Leung, who is under Tong Qihua, and Tong Qihua somehow traced back to Jiang Zemin. So we all said the CY Leung is somehow like from the Jiang Zemin faction. Until nowadays, we don't see him announcing any campaign for the re-election for the next March. So my question to the panel will be, if the Hong Kong secession issue would be a battleground or a test field for the current internal struggle of the CCP's elites, who will be the next successor in this special administrative region? Do you have any names in your mind? Thank you.
Who would like to take this one? And I like proud of your diction. You said succession, not secession. That's important to keep in mind in thinking about Hong Kong these days. So who would like to take this question? Chris?
I would only say that it doesn't strike me that the issue of succession of the chief executive is going to be something that's going to cause real trouble inside the Chinese leadership. My sense is the leadership appears to be quite unified on the approach to Hong Kong. I think the issue to probably emphasize is, will Beijing take the opportunity that they have to have a look at the recent election results in Hong Kong and determine whether they can be confident enough to pick one among several candidates that appear to be emerging that have some credibility with Hong Kongers and aren't just seen as sort of toting Beijing's line. But that'd be the only thing I have to say.
I would like to add that, in fact, the challenges in Hong Kong, since we are at a conference on cross-strait relations, actually, the troubles in some ways in Hong Kong are really good for in terms of when in comparison with the issues in Taiwan, because Hong Kong constantly looms on the mind of mainland leaders nowadays. So as a result, they have to spend a lot of time on considering, on thinking through the Hong Kong issue.
So Jim?
I don't have any clue about names. But I heard from some of my Hong Kong friends about the Fishbowl Rebellion issue. They think that the way the local police handled this issue was very unusual, unusually harsh, which actually has the effect of destabilizing Hong Kong's order and does not serve the purpose of Beijing. So a lot of people have a lot of suspicion on who is behind, who was behind this. And so that's one thing I heard about. Another thing I have to say, and following Dali's point, since this is talking about cross-strait relations, I have to tell you, from Taiwan's perspective, it has very bad example. It's a very bad example of one country, two systems, given what's going on in Hong Kong to Taiwan. This formula is losing a lot of credibility given what's going on in Hong Kong. So I don't know if that's in the mind of Beijing's leadership, but this is very true. Yeah.
I think to some degree, Hong Kong's elections result maybe can serve as kind of indicator for the hardliner and the softliner in Zhongnanhai, because right now the possible three candidates for the next year's 特首. The one is Liang Zhenying, the other two is Zheng Yucheng and Zheng Junhua. And all we know that Zheng Yucheng just 3 weeks ago became a Time magazine's figure in the front page. And the title set by the Time magazine actually is Hong Kong's Hope. So it's a very strange shift because we know that Zheng Junhua's for the long time, he served as the like a speaker of the Hong Kong's Legislative Council, and he's kind of a soft line of the pan Beijing's politician, and Liang Zhenying represented the hard, the hawkish ways of the pan Beijing's politician. So if the Liang Zhenying can run his can be elected for his second term, that means the Xi or the hardliner toward Hong Kong's situation to take advantage. And especially after the Zhang Dejiang visited Hong Kong 1.5 months ago, Liang Zhenying shifted his approach, the hawkish approach, to softener toward the so-called the pan-democratic front in Hong Kong, and even keep a more mild approach to those so-called radical Hong Kong independence, those young generation, we call as a post the Embraer Revolution, those politicians. And those young person, most of them, they were elected as the lawmaker in this just past election. So I think the next indicator for the Hong Kong's election and from the Beijing perspective is those radical pro-independent new lawmaker can be or not invited by Beijing to visit Beijing, because that's a custom is an all new lawmaker, especially the Pan Beijing where the soft Pan Democratic lawmaker can be invited to Beijing. So this time we can observe those new generation, those poor post umbrella revolutions, the leader of those movements, especially for those who get elected as a lawmaker, can be whether or not they can be invited to visit Beijing.
Okay, that's perfect. All good comments. Okay, right here in the fifth row.
Hi, Nadia Chow with the Liberty Times. I have a question for Mr. Christopher Johnson. I think many people in Taiwan want to know that for the Taiwan policy, the Xi Jinping is really the dominant figure, can make all the major decisions, because we saw a lot of speculation that sometimes he has, you know, people trying to pretend to help him, but actually hurting his Taiwan policy. And so from your perspective, is he really, you know, totally control of the Taiwan policy? And early on, Richard mentioned that seems to be a change of expectation from Beijing to Tsai Ing-wen's response, especially on the 92 consensus. From his, you know, her inauguration, people thought that Taiwan may already pass the major challenge, but later on we saw a different demand. You know, do you recognize this, or do you have a different opinion? Thank you.
Thank you, and certainly would welcome my co-panelists' views on this as well. My own is that he is firmly in control of Taiwan policy, like he's firmly in control of most other elements, or all other elements of policy, from what I can tell. So I don't think there's any great struggle over Taiwan policy. His views are probably do tend toward the more firm, but as we've heard already this morning, he's been willing to show some level of flexibility in his approach. I think that one of the concerns we talked earlier on an earlier panel about unlikely but unexpected possibilities that could come up. One of those, I think, is that, you know, the sense that I get when I look at this problem is, you know, in the previous administration, when they were pursuing the policies of pro-engagement, there's always a constituency on the Chinese side, on the mainland side, that argues we have given Taiwan quite a bit, you know, whether it be ECFA or early harvest and so on. And yet, on the core issue of sovereignty, what have we gotten in return? Nothing, right? And I think the people who were pushing the policies, Hu Jintao and his colleagues, of the sort of engagement were saying, yes, but you'll admit that the economic benefits have been pretty nice, haven't they? And those others, I think, then would say, well, okay, I guess you're right, and struggle along with that. With the seeming shift in some of the economic strategy under the Tsai administration, looking more toward the South policy and so on, I'm concerned that the voices that argue that we're not getting anything will get louder. In other words, if that economic leg is perceived in the mainland as being somehow kind of kicked out from underneath the relationship, the voices could get much stronger, and I'm not sure how much persuasion Xi Jinping would require to listen to them.
Okay. Anyone else? Let me do a two-finger on this, not on on Taiwan policy, but on a person who, to me, looks like the bureau chief of administrative reform in Beijing, a gentleman named Li Keqiang. Also the premier, but doesn't seem to be doing much of the premier's typical duties. But there's been a lot of reporting, and maybe this is just an echo chamber, about the tension between Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang. What this means for the back and forth in policy, perhaps, that Chris cited, or the level of confidence that Xi Jinping may or may not have. I know Dolly said that she feels relatively confident playing all these different games at the same time. But does that mean, then one would wonder, why does he need to be amass so much power and leave the premier with very little? Li Keqiang's coming to the United States next week, but it's his first trip outside Asia this year. He's been allowed to go as far as Mongolia and Laos before this trip. So I was curious what you all see in that relationship between these two pivotal figures.
First of all, in fact, I think to this day, there hasn't been a formal announcement of Li Keqiang's visit to the U.S. from the Chinese side. The Canadian side has already indicated, is announcing that he's visiting Canada and so on. So it's really a very interesting kind of phenomenon. I think you're absolutely right in this context that there was actually internally some criticism of the relationship in the sense that Li Keqiang was so significantly overshadowed that he simply became became just so focused on just the one issue called innovation. So as a result, there was some discontent related to that. Now, I don't want to go into the complexities, but in fact, part of the issue is also because some of the policies of innovation, especially in the financial sphere, produced repercussions that didn't help Li Keqiang because of the fraud and so on with the P2P initiatives and all that. The other fact was that initially when Li became the premier, his first initiative, in fact, if some of you may remember, was on urbanization. That was immediately created a phenomenon of many villages pushing their residents into high-rises and a lot of land confiscation. And she essentially put that to a stop. So as a result, I think actually this is an evolutionary relationship in a way. And of course, as Xi has taken on the leadership group positions, whether it's finance and economics and others, so he simply he has dominated. So there are other possibilities to think about it. But overall, though, I do think actually when he's on playing so many games simultaneously, you have to drop the ball from time to time. It's just impossible to keep everything in the air as a result. But at the same time, some of the issues of reform are simply so difficult to tackle, including the issue of debt. Right? But let's also keep in mind that the debt level in China has reached the U.S. level. So in other words, it depends on how you pose the issue. It's high, but it's also every other major developed country has debt levels that are just as high as China's. The Chinese economy has to slow down, but at the same time, there is significant efforts to reform as well, or certainly in terms of dynamic changes with Chinese economies shifting to more economic and service sectors and so on. So all of those actually are issues that are on the docket. My sense is actually when it comes in the end, I think a lot of the issues would be what would be the role of Li Keqiang going forward? Would he continue to be the prime minister or is he going to be shifted to another position? By previous rules, the only two people who actually are at the age to retain their seats on the Politburo Standing Committee. And that raises very interesting issues, definitely. In there. The other issue is also a lot of the ministerial changes will be very interesting, I think, actually, including also at the provincial level. And again, typically it's the party secretary who dominates the scene compared to the premier. But Li is not, certainly, I mean, he has certain influence in there. So I think this game will continue. But I do want to mention one final point. Li actually is very interesting in the sense that he has not been seen, number one, he's not been considered to be corrupt. Number two, he's also being seen as not being really pushing his own faction or something like that. So he's played a very interesting political game. So it's very hard for Xi to, except for policy errors, it's very hard for Xi to say, you're my enemy or something like that. In fact, Li gains a lot of sympathy by not being seen as very aggressive, which is a very interesting kind of situation in the Chinese context at this moment.
Sort of the anti-Bo Xi Lai. Chris? No? Okay, all right. Yes, Harry.
Thank you. I'm Harry Harding of the University of Virginia and Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. My question is for Professor Xu, and I would invite him to say a little bit more about what he sees as the evolving relationship between the party state and the Chinese middle class. If I understood you correctly, you argued that protest discontent is beginning to spread upward, if you will, in the structure from the lower classes, farmers, working classes, up to the middle class. But that at the same time, the party state's response to that, and those are largely material concerns, the party state's response is not to negotiate material or policy solutions, but rather to crack down. And if I understood that correctly, then I'm curious as to what you see are the costs and benefits, or benefits and risks, of that shift in approach. Because I would think that, first of all, material concerns are far easier to deal with through negotiation than concerns that involve more fundamental structural issues, and especially if they begin to morph into concerns about values, freedom of speech, press, democracy, and so forth, freedom of assembly and organization. And doesn't a crackdown response increase the possibility that the concerns will begin to morph away from purely the material and over to the more basically political? So I don't understand the logic of that trend, if indeed, and I have no doubt that your analysis is correct. I may have misunderstood it, however. If indeed that's occurring, I would see this as a rather risky strategy over the longer term.
Go ahead. Oh, yeah. Professor Joe.
Okay, I think my point is that according to my own observation, some of the middle class group, they do show their willingness to participate in to some degree the policy making, or at least they can express their interest. And to some degree, they also through the kind of the protest, but as you just mentioned, and also as well as in my presentation, the most of their interest is focused on the material needs. So it's easier for the government to persuade or try to control this kind of unrest from the middle class through the kind of economic profit to them. But to some degree, low so-called middle class, for example, the business person or even the teachers, they will cooperate to some human rights lawyer, and try to protect their own interests through the expanding the channel for them to express their own opinion. But there's a bottom line. They can aware this kind of a bottom line. So for them, there are kind of a red line or the bottom line for those middle class. They will not cross that, but to some degree, because sometimes they will use their the social status or their resources through a kind of an indirect way to cooperate with some, as I said, the human rights lawyer or other group, they feel unsatisfied to the current social situation. But it's also easy for the government to provide some the material profit for them. So, and rather than to presume some the hawkish or very hard way to crack down those the middle class levels or middle class persons, their Protestants. Okay.
yeah, I agree with Professor Harding's observation that this is a strategy that does not serve its own purpose. But I think the root of the problem comes from what I mentioned in my presentation, that the Xi Jinping's regime harbors this, I think, a false perception that there is some kind of a clandestine coalition between external opponent forces and the internal elements, you know, rebellion elements. And some of the NGOs or civil society forces are identified by Xi Jinping regime as the instigating elements. For example, this lawyers group has been, I think, intentionally rounded up, you know, and as a showcase, because it has very clear overseas connection. You know, it's a showcase that there's such a conspiracy, you know, enemy exists. I think he has a deep sense of insecurity. So this is why, you know, in the later stage of Hu Jintao's regime, a lot of scholars studying Chinese politics has identified the phenomena that the authoritarian regime can coexist with a burgeoning civil society. And they say it's a sign of authoritarian resilience, but that resilience is gone because of this kind of false perception. Thank you.
For another question? You're asked out, I guess. I guess your stomachs are speaking to you, if that could be. We've had a full discussion, a good 360 on domestic politics and economics and social change. I was just trying to recall my Samuel Huntington reading, and as you all were going back and forth on that last question, which I'll think about during lunch, which reminds me to explain. For lunch this afternoon, you're going to go back through the doors in the back of the room, across the hallway to the summer's room, which is where we've laid out the buffet for everybody, and you're welcome to eat there or in here or outside in front, depending on what you feel about the temperature. There's another conference going on to our side, so you don't want to go out this door and take their food, because that won't leave enough for them. But, of course, that's where the bathroom facilities are. So we're going to adjourn right now, and then I think we're going to come back at just before 1 o'clock. And then we'll have a luncheon presentation. I know this one you won't want to miss. It's going to be fantastic. Enjoy your lunch, and see you all in just a few minutes. Please join me in thanking the panelists.